call this meeting to order up the Workforce Committee. See that there is a quorum. Representative Henderson Yeager, would you like to move adoption of minutes from March 6, 2024?
So moved.
Any additions or corrections? I see that there is a date that needs to be corrected on top, so the CLA will make the correction on that. Chair Beckerfin.
My name is misspelled on the first page, if that could be corrected.
Well, note that, and CLA will make the correction. Any further discussions to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. First on the agenda this morning is House File 3446. Representative Kayla Bergs, UI bill. Chair Beckerfin will move that House File 3446 be re-referred to the Ways and Means bill. And I do see that we also have an author's amendment, a DE one amendment. Chair Beckerfin will move the adoption with a DE one amendment. Representative Berg, welcome to committee. And please explain.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This amendment is just basically to get the bill in the order which I prefer, which is to qualify workers to get unemployment insurance immediately.
Okay. All those in favor of adopting the DE1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. To your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. As a proud rank and file union member, I am honored and humbled to be able to bring this bill before you today. Unions provide workers a stronger voice on the job, and as a result, unions also significantly reduce wage gaps between men and women, between white workers and people of color and indigenous workers. Despite this, employers still maintain significant power over workers and know that time is on their side if they can draw out negotiations with their workers. This is because employers understand the incredible burden that a strike places on workers, particularly low-wage workers, who can't afford to support their families if they go out on strike, which is why strikes, especially those lasting more than a week, are not only uncommon, but are of a last resort to workers. We often witness this power imbalance in seemingly unending bargaining over first contracts, as we continue to see with Starbucks. We see it in employers forcing workers into long, open-ended strikes in order to get workers to accept lower wages and benefits, which is a strategy we saw during the Writers Guild strike last year, when one studio executive told an industry news outlet that, quote, "The end game is to allow things to drag on until union members start losing their apartments and losing their houses," end quote. And make no mistake, workers are not going on long open-ended strikes voluntarily in the same way that someone might choose to get a new job. They are forced out on strike by their employer's refusal to bargain a fair contract when there is no other choice. This bill will grant striking workers the same access to their unemployment benefits as any other worker, which already includes locked out workers. And like other workers, striking workers would need to observe the same non-payable week, which means that only those uncommon strikes lasting more than a week will result in any unemployment insurance benefits being paid to striking workers. But even this will help reduce the power imbalance that workers face as they bargain for not just their own wages, benefits, and safety, but for the good of their families, their community, and future workers in their industries, which helps the entire economy. However, UI only provides partial wage replacement to merely soften the risk to workers' families. So this bill only goes so far in leveling the playing field, and strikes will continue to be a last resort. According to a report released just yesterday by the North Star Institute, this proposal is estimated to cost the UI Trust Fund just 0.3%, which will be replenished through the established UI premium process, most directly affecting those employers who will see a higher experience rating from forcing their workers out on strikes over unfair labor practices. This deterrent is yet one more way that this bill would help to level the playing field in bargaining. Let's not forget that we, here in this room, the legislature, poured $2.7 billion into the UI Trust Fund. Rather than requiring employers to replenish the trust fund through the established process after the initial period of the pandemic and saving millions of dollars of obligations under the law for each of our state's largest employers. I am asking for your support for House File 3446, Senate File 3588, to help close some of the power imbalance that employers hold to give workers a chance to bargain for fair contracts that provide livable wages, affordable benefits, and a safe workplace, and in turn, support our entire Minnesota economy. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Berg. I believe you have some testifiers. So the first one is Bart Anderson. Welcome to committee. Please identify yourself for record and share your pronouns if you'd like. And please limit your testimony to 2 minutes, as we have a long list of testifiers here and we want to allow time for members to ask questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning, members. My name is Bart Anderson. For the last 7 months, I have served as interim executive director for AFSCME Council 5. On behalf of AFSCME Council 5, I'm here to strongly support the passage of House File 3446 and Senate File 3588, which will make Minnesota the third state where striking workers can have access to unemployment insurance benefits. I want to thank Representative Berg, Senator Muhammad, among others, for prioritizing the working people of Minnesota. The decisions workers make when they collectively vote to go out on strike are never taken lightly. It's one that comes with enormous financial consideration and is a tactic of last resort. Partial wage replacement provided through unemployment insurance will not change these facts. I know that from my own personal experience. Before my time working for AFSCME, I was an AFSCME member. I was a bridge inspector for the Department of Transportation, where I started back in 1997. In 2001, the last time state workers went out on strike, I had a very young family at home. Something that was true then and is still true today, child care is not cheap. Luckily, that strike didn't go into a third week, and thankfully, the financial hardship my family experienced at the time didn't drag on either. But it was difficult. Going 2 or 3 weeks without pay is really hard for any worker. And even under this proposal, having a strike go on longer than a few weeks, when the only financial support a worker will receive is 50% or less of their average weekly wage, going out on strike will still be financially challenging, but at least workers won't be starved back to work. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing your story. Next is Jake Switzer. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and feel free to share your pronouns if you'd like and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Zhang, members of the committee. My name is Jake Schweitzer, and I am the Executive Director of North Star Policy Action. We are a think tank that promotes data-driven solutions to help working Minnesotans thrive. I'm here to speak in favor of House File 3446. One critical obstacle to making Minnesota a better state for working people is rising inequality. Between 2009 and 2021, corporate profits in the United States grew 3 times more than average earnings. In 1965, CEOs made 21 times more than their average worker. Today, they make 344 times more. When workers advocate for better pay to reduce this inequality, this is the reality they face. And if they attempt to use their most powerful tool, their ability to strike and withhold their labor, this is the imbalance that billionaire-backed corporations understand, that they can use their considerable profits to engage in bad faith negotiating tactics and simply wait out their poorly paid workers. Representative Berg already alluded to the comments from a Hollywood executive. Workers should not be forced to choose between losing their homes and fighting for their dignity. To bring balance to this equation, Minnesota should follow the model of other states and expand unemployment insurance to cover striking workers. Doing so will provide workers with peace of mind, knowing that if they need to strike, they will have access to a small but essential level of assistance to protect their families from hardship. To evaluate the impact of this expansion, North Star analyzed the costs and benefits of the state taking this step. On the cost side, we found that providing striking workers with UI would represent between just 0.2 and 0.3% of all UI claims paid out by the state. This minuscule cost is greatly overshadowed by the tremendous benefits of this change. Our analysis shows that providing striking workers with unemployment insurance can move the state toward a better balance between corporate and worker power, all while incurring a negligible cost. In doing so, Minnesota can prevent its population from being forced to choose between feeding their families and fighting for the better pay, family-sustaining benefits, and safe working conditions that allow working people in Minnesota to thrive. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you to testify. Next is Todd Ballstrom. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record. Feel free to share your pronouns if you like and proceed with your testimony.
Todd Dahlstrom. So good morning, Mr. Chair and the committee members. My name is Todd Dahlstrom. I'm the Organizing and Growth Director for the Minnesota AFL-CIO, the state's federation of more than 1,000 local unions who represent over 300,000 working people in every corner of our state and nearly every kind of job. I'm here to speak in favor of House File 3446. Our labor movement envisions a state where all workers, working people, have safe workplaces, a job that can sustain a family, time to spend with a family, and a dignified retirement. Both historically and to this day, workers taking collective action, including going on strike, has been the most effective way to move us closer to that vision. While strikes are the most effective tactic for workers to win gains, a strike also carries the most risk. Federal labor laws are tilted in favor of the employers, who can lock out and temporarily replace workers, stall negotiations, make threats, cut health care, and more. For example, when a manager locks out workers, they aren't making a personal sacrifice. They don't lose a penny of pay or their health benefits. But when workers decide to go on strike, it often means no pay for workers and families for an uncertain amount of time. Mr. Chair and committee members, we can't change federal labor law here in St. Paul, but we can balance the scales for working Minnesotans by allowing workers to access unemployment insurance during a strike. Access to UI will not only keep food on the tables for working families, but will also mean shorter strikes. When managers know that workers have a lifeline, they lose the incentive to what, well, once again, the Disney CEO, Bob Iger, calling during the workers' strike, quote, starve them out before going back to the table. Mr. Chair and representatives, let's continue making Minnesota the best state for workers by passing House File 3446. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Next is John Councilman. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record, feel free to share pronouns, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is John Councilman. I'm the Secretary Treasurer of UAW Local 125. I work at the Stellantis Parts Distribution Center in Plymouth. I'm here to speak in favor of House File 3446. Along with 145,000 of my fellow auto workers, I was one of a portion of that was on strike against my employer in the weeks of September and October for 5 weeks. Going on strike was the last resort to get my company to negotiate a fair contract. Even though we had a strike authorization vote of 98%, I don't know any one of us that actually wanted to go on strike. The uncertainty of no or reduced income for an unknown amount of time was very stressful and worrying. We got by with a small portion of strike assistance from our union strike fund, but if we didn't have that lifeline, it would have been even more difficult to provide for some of the basic needs for our families. Since we had drastically reduced income for over a month, I found out we all could have applied for SNAP benefits. As I was working on gathering that information, we ended up getting a tentative agreement, so we never had to submit for those benefits. The strike I was on didn't have to take 5 weeks because these employers knew what their top offer was. Managers didn't sacrifice a penny while they tried to starve us out. And despite pleading poverty for weeks, they ended up agreeing to a record 4-year contract. And while they're pleading poverty, they made enough money last year to provide average profit sharing checks of $13,800 per worker. Our contract win led to wage increases across the auto industry for both union and non-union workers alike, because when union workers win at the negotiating table, all workers end up winning. Workers need to be eligible for unemployment insurance while on strike, both to help us provide for our families while we fight for the wages and benefits that we deserve, and to motivate employers to negotiate a faster end to the strike or a faster contract settlement. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for sharing your story. Next is Jay Shetland. Please identify yourself for, I apologize. Alexia Hitchings, welcome to committee. Please identify yourself for the record. share your pronouns if you like, and proceed with your testimony.
Hello, Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Alexia Hitchings, and I've been a registered nurse in the metro area for the past 12 years. I'm here to testify in support of the House File 3446 that expands unemployment access to striking workers. I've been on strike three times, twice in 2016 and again in 2022. As someone who has a family and cares for the community and my own home to heed, I can tell you that I do not want to go on strike. Nurses do not want to strike, but collective action is the most effective way for us workers to advocate for ourselves and for ourselves to improve our work conditions. It has been the only way for us to fight for safe staffing while fighting back against billion-dollar healthcare corporations who want us to do more with less. Our employers have spent millions and millions of dollars in hiring temporary workers to replace us during a strike, and they are happy to spend that money rather than a bargain, a fair contract with us. I am proud to have gone on strike in the past, but it comes at a cost. When I went on strike for 1 week and then again for 6 weeks in 2016, it was a huge burden on my family, on myself and my family. We stopped all activities for our young kids because I did not know when we would work again. I became sick at the end of the 2016 strike. We lost our health insurance for a month. Without insurance and income, I held off on going to the doctors until the day we got our insurance back after the strike ended. I had a sinus infection that became so bad it ruptured my eardrum, and I had hearing loss for several months. A simple sinus infection turned into a huge health event for me because I was scared to incur more health bills than my family could afford. It took a long time for us to financially recover from that six-week strike. I was better prepared for the 2022 strike, but I saw my coworkers struggle going up against our multi-billion dollar employer in our fight for safe staffing at the bedside. I strike because I want my children to have a better working condition than I do. I strike because I want my coworkers to have safe working conditions. I strike because I care about my patients and I want them to receive the best care possible. I strike because my employer forces me to because our nation's labor laws remain heavily skewed in favor of employers, giving them the ability to lock us out, temporarily replace us, stall negotiations, make threats, and cut off our health care. And when managers legally lock out workers, they don't lose a penny of their pay or health benefits. But when we do strike, we do not have a choice. This pill comes with a lifeline for some. While unemployment insurance won't cover my entire income, it would allow me to feed my children, go to the emergency room if I need to, and prevent my employer from starving us out in a tactic to delay negotiations and force us to accept a contract that is harmful. If our employer knew we had this lifeline, there would be more equitability bargaining for negotiation, fair contract, perhaps shortening or preventing strikes in the future. Thank you for your time today, and thank you, Representative Berg, for carrying this pro-worker, pro-nurse, pro-patient bill. I hope this committee will support it.
Thank you. Next is Jay from United Steel's Worker. Welcome to committee. Please identify yourself for the record. Share your pronouns if you like, and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Zhang and members of the committee. My name is Jay Chatlin, and I am president of the United Steelworkers Local 142B in Mankato, Minnesota. Representative Berg, thank you for introducing this legislation. In July of 23, myself and my members were forced to go on strike because of unsafe working conditions and the employer's unwillingness to bargain in good faith. My employer refused to implement safety measures to provide safe working conditions for myself and my colleagues. The overall OSHA recordable rate for the foundry I work in was 14%, with some departments having an OSHA recordable rate as high as 98.98%. My employer utilized a behavioral-based safety program to drive down OSHA recordable rates. Behavioral-based safety programs use discipline, threats of discipline, and monetary bonuses to discourage reporting of injuries. This approach rarely addresses safety hazards in the workplace. For example, if a guard is missing on a piece of equipment, an employee loses a tip of their finger, they'll discipline that employee without addressing actual hazards. Another employee will be injured in the same hazard. This is why we see OSHA recordable rates as high as 98.98%. Prior to the expiration of our contract, we actively tried to make changes to the safety culture within the foundry. The employer repeatedly told us, if it isn't broken, why fix it? But when you have an OSHA recordable rate at 98.98%, the process is certainly broken. When we started contract negotiations, we made it clear that safety was our number one priority. Our employer refused to bargain over safety and continued to respond with, if it isn't broken, why fix it? Even when we could clearly show the safety program was broken, my employer refused to bargain in good faith. Employees literally had to choose between paying their bills or going on strike to protect themselves from being injured. We ultimately made the choice to go on strike, but I can tell you that was a very hard decision. Long story short, the strike lasted for 11 days, and we were able to secure language that drastically changed the safety culture. Without the strike, this would never have happened. Employees should never have to make the choice between paying their bills or working in an unsafe workplace. This legislation would allow workers to strike for a safe working place while being able to feed their families. I support this legislation. I would ask all of you to do the same. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next is Sarah Gallert from Hastings Food Service Worker. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record. Feel free to share your pronouns if you like, and proceed with your testimony.
Chair and members, my name is Sarah Gallup. I'm a short hour cook or food service worker from Hastings. I was part of the Hastings food service strike last year. That's why I'm here today supporting this bill. Before starting the Hastings Public School, I was a stay-at-home mom living with a disability. I thought food service would be perfect for my job because of the short hours and the school schedule matches my kids. My son goes to the middle school where I work. These are difficult, fast-paced jobs, and we deserve the respect. Recently, my school was supposed to have a pizza party. Domino's delivered the pizzas to the wrong school. We had 20 minutes to figure out what we were doing for the kids. Thankfully, they didn't know. Our kids starting wages are $13.85 an hour, less than McDonald's or most other places. No one wants to strike, but I favor two because we deserve better. No one wants to strike. Okay. No one wants to strike, but I favored the strike because we deserve better. Our jobs deserve respect and appreciation. They wanted to offer my supervisor a 35-cent raise for being there 25 years. I started my job in October, and I felt I had finally gotten my head above water. When we got on strike on February 6th, being without my school income hurt, and the support from my union could offer me, strike wasn't enough. The district could have ended the strike at any time. We are only about $150,000 apart in negotiations, and one of the school board meetings during the strike, contractor was installing signs in front of our schools to look better in the rocks. If the rocks on the signs matched the color of the bricks in the buildings, but it would cost another $150,000. District management was happy to spend more on rocks than on the caring adults who nourish our children. This bill would help workers like me stand up for and fight for what we deserve, and I encourage you to support it, please.
Thank you for your testimony. Next is Dr. Terrence Morrow from the Minnesota School Boards Association. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and share your pronouns if you like, and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Chair and members. My name is Terry Morrow. I am the Legal and Policy Director for the Minnesota School Boards Association, and would like to be really clear. We certainly respect staff. We respect every one of the experiences that's been described here so far this morning. I come today to describe the unique situation that school districts would face under this bill. The way that unemployment works, the state does pay the unemployment benefits directly to staff. to workers who, for in this case, are on strike. The school districts then reimburse the state funds. So that fund is, that amount is actually finally, ultimately paid by the school district. Now, I'd like to work through a hypothetical with you. If, for example, teachers were to go on strike under this bill, classes would not be held each day that the teachers were on strike. I'm not picking on teachers. I'm simply saying school would not be held each day of that strike. The school district would pay the unemployment benefits ultimately for those teachers. And then when school is then resumed and those class days are made up, the districts would pay again. So in essence, paying twice for a single day of instruction for our staff. The impact on property taxpayers would be significant because schools can pass along unemployment benefit costs to property taxpayers. This would then end up being a property tax increase to the local communities. Again, schools are unique. Board members do not make profit sharing. Board members do not make the type of compensation that has been correctly described in other situations. What we're asking for here today is to consider the unique situation schools are in under this bill. We don't have the budget to pay twice. We understand the need. We want to work well with all of our employees. We believe in balanced negotiations, and we look forward to working with Representative Berg to address the unique problem that school districts and schools and students would face under this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next is Hunter Cantrell. Welcome to committee. Please identify yourself for the record. Share your pronouns if you like and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Hunter Cantrell. My pronouns are he, him. I am here today as a former state representative, former union member, current medical student, to testify strongly in favor of this nation-leading bill. And I thank Representative Berg for her tireless work and advocacy on this and her decades of work in the labor movement. I'm here because working people across all sectors, including my sector of healthcare and education, with many Minnesota educators potentially being forced out onto the picket line in the near future to save their profession, are suffering. Corporations continue to make record profits while heavily investing in anti-union law firms that actively stall collective bargaining negotiations and refuse to agree to basic safety reforms and compensation increases necessary for workers to feel safe and stable in the workplace. We are at a historic junction in the movement to secure economic prosperity for the whole working class in Minnesota, especially at a time of soaring corporate profits and unfettered price gouging while many working families are grappling with the cost of living crisis. For too long, the scales of power have been weighted against working people, with obvious advantages being cemented on the side of wealthy employers and big corporations. Well, today, we are saying no more. Today, with this bill, we are saying that when you as a corporation engage in bad faith tactics designed to deliberately frustrate the collective bargaining process and drive workers to the picket line, whose labor is often exploited and from which we all benefit so greatly, that these workers will not be abandoned and starved of financial stability. I want to see businesses and workers alike thrive. But workers need financial stability in their lives and safety in the workplace. As Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said, no work is insignificant. All labor that uplifts humanity has dignity and importance. Thank you, and I urge passage of the bill. Thanks.
Thank you, Hunter Cantrell. Next is Dean Benson from Teamsters Local 120. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record. Feel free to share your pronouns and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Dean Benson, and I'm a proud retiree of Teamsters Local 120, and I'm here to speak in favor of House File 3446. I've worked at the Marathon St. Paul Park Refinery for 19 years and retired in 2023. As many of you know, I was locked out of my job in 2021 with 200 of my union brothers and sisters. This lockout turned into a strike, and it lasted 6 months. We won that fight, but only because we had the support we needed to keep the fight going. This isn't always the case, because Marathon did what many large corporations do when their workers are seeking fair contracts. They tried to starve us out. If they kept us from working long enough, they believed we'd become desperate enough to get back to work, so desperate that we'd ignore all our grievances just to get a paycheck again. This isn't an anomaly. This is the playbook for strike breakers. The thing is, when workers go on strike, the stakes are very different for two sides. corporate bosses get mean phone calls, upset shareholders, and annoyed customers. Hardworking men and women get tough decisions about putting food on the table, medicine in their cabinet, and a roof over their head. We went on strike at Marathon because we knew our workplace wasn't safe enough, because we wanted to know that we were going to come home from work and see our families each day. We didn't make the choice lightly. Strikes are the last option on the table, but we did it for the safety of our colleagues, for the community, and around the refinery. This legislation would make it easier for those in similar situations to fight for the safety of themselves and others. It would help. It would make it harder for corporations to starve out workers who are asking for safe and healthy workplaces, a living wage, or more dignity in their work. It would help ensure that labor disputes are settled at the negotiating table, not at the workers' kitchen table. So I ask you, as you think about this bill and which way you're going to vote, do you support the act of starving out hardworking families, or should we level the playing field with this legislation? Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. I am told from Mr. Reese that we have a last-minute testifier from the League of Minnesota Cities. So if you are here, welcome to committee. Please identify yourself for the record. Feel free to show your pronouns and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Lisa Schaefer, and I'm the Human Resources Director for the League of Minnesota Cities. First, I'd like to recognize the long history of successful Minnesota collective bargaining, especially in public sector. It's long given employers and employees the ability to meet and negotiate in good faith, and has, especially in Minnesota cities, pretty rarely in our history led to actual strikes. The reason this bill is so concerning for cities and public employers is that in the event of a strike, there are still fundamental services that need to be provided, especially for public safety in an emergency. So if there's a water main break or a snow plow, streets need to be plowed so that emergency vehicles can get through. And if a bargaining group is going on strike, the city would still need to provide coverage for that. This bill would pay unemployment benefits for striking workers, and just as the school boards association had described, cities are also reimbursing employers. So that means the entire cost of unemployment benefits is charged back to the city in the event that employees are on strike. The intent of unemployment has been to provide employees with unemployment benefits if they are unable to work, or if they're locked out, or if work is not available through no fault of their own, and we would like to respectfully request that remain in place. Included in your packet is a letter on behalf of League of Minnesota Cities. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Seeing that there are no more testifiers on the list, we will move to discussion of the bill. And first on the list is Lee Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the author of the bill, Representative Berg, I've been here for 10 years, and I meet with our union members, and thank you all for being here today. This is important for us to hear. I've met with them every year, from AFSCME to folks around our areas, and this is, I guess, a little surprising, because this has never come up in our discussions before, this benefit. And I don't know if this has this been brought to the legislature before, this question about paying folks on unemployment insurance during a strike. So has this been proposed before? And why haven't I heard of this before? Because, again, we have great relationships with our construction trades and things. So I'm just curious about that. Thank you.
Representative Berg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Great question, Representative Baker. I've only been here 4 years, so I'm not sure if it's been brought to the legislature before. Perhaps research.
Ms. James.
Mr. Chair, Representative Baker, I am not aware of anything offhand, but that's something I could certainly research for you.
Thank you.
Representative Baker.
Thank you. And I have a couple more questions. And because of that, again, I hear concerns about, I think this worker safety thing has really gone a long ways. And our unions have a lot of things to celebrate because our workplaces are safer because of their voices. But I've heard, in the last couple of years, they're really concerned about things that are happening that they didn't ask for, like paid family and things like that were not part of their negotiating table. So I hear both sides of this. So this is why I keep asking, again, My concern with this bill is that you said 0.3 tenths of a percent of the UI fund. I'll ask you this question in twofold. What does that number look like? Because that's a real number, and it's bigger than 0.3 of something. So also, as we heard from the School Board Association and other, even the cities, there are uniquenesses to all types of workers. And some of them, like, for example, teachers, if they go on strike, they typically negotiate then for back pay from the day they left. And I know what, I'm not saying that this delay in payment is easy for anyone, but that typically is renegotiated or negotiated part of the contract. How does that then get paid back to the funds? It's kind of a two-question thing, if you could tell me that.
Representative Byrd.
Thank you, Chair. So trying to remember both of your questions, I would have research answer what the 0.3 of 1% actually looks like number-wise. Per your other questions, actually, the paid family medical leave, the earned sick and safe time, some of the things that we put in place by the state are actually incredibly appreciated by our labor friends and workers. And so that actually frees up more of their contract for negotiating for other things that they've been asking for. And so that is not something that our labor friends are actually concerned about. They appreciate that. In terms of different unique situations per industry, you're always going to have that. For example, with the schools and school workers, they actually only have to pay back 50% into the strike fund, which is still 50% less than the budgeted amount for their workers for that time. So it's a little bit less than it sounds like. But I would go ahead and have Marta talk about what the numbers look like, and we can address the other things again.
Ms. James.
Mr. Chair, I'll defer to my fiscal analyst colleague.
Ms. Thing.
Mr. Chair, a fiscal note has been requested. I'm not sure where that number came from.
Okay. Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And final, and just finally, again, different members say different things about the benefits that they've asked for now. I'm not going to disagree that there's a lot of them that want some of these benefits, but I know union members are very, very focused on what they want. They want to be able to talk about it at the union negotiating table. I've learned that very much over my years here. And finally, maybe my question is, the Unemployment Advisory Council is very involved in how our fund is, how it's stable. Labor and management are both there. Has this been proposed to the council, and what was their maybe either recommendations or what was their feedback to you when you wrote this bill about what did the advisory council say about this bill?
Representative Byrd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Baker. We actually reached out to them as well as had numerous conversations with Deed, and Deed actually helped write some of the language in this bill. So prior to it being submitted and brought before your committee, we did have those conversations.
Lead Baker.
Finally, so I didn't hear the answer. Did it go to the advisory council? Did they give you a recommendation on this bill? So that's different than Deed.
Representative Baker. I mean, Representative Byrd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did reach out to the advisory council and didn't receive any resistance or any recommendations back from them.
Thank you.
Lead Baker. Any further discussions to the bill? Chair Becca Fenn.
Thank you, Chair Zhang. And one thing I wanted to bring up, I always like for the record sort of thing is, you know, sort of in the same way we have groups who claim they speak for all gun owners or claim they speak for all of a certain group of people. I just wanted to sort of call out, you know, I know there's a letter in here from the NFIB and, you know, proclaiming to speak for small businesses, and as a small business owner, they don't speak for me, and I think it's just really important that we recognize that. Often we folks use the term small business as a way to gain credibility, but the reality is we could be talking about a mom and pop restaurant in your community, but we could also be talking about an employer who has up to 750 employees or makes $40 million a year, which those are vastly different organizations, and so I just wanted to point that out, that that not is not necessarily speaking for all small businesses. Many of us who own small businesses, our employees know us and we know them, and you know, there's just isn't the power imbalance, and really that's what we're talking about here, is the power imbalance. The whole reason we have unions in the first place is because the power imbalance between the employer and the employees, and any individual employee on their own is not going to be able to stand up to the power that some of these large corporations and organizations have. So just wanted to call that out and kind of talk about, you know, this is really what we're talking about philosophically here, is like, how do we balance that power so that it's not extremely unfair to working people. Somebody always benefits from the way that our systems are set up. And so I just wanted us to sort of think about it that way and not get lost in the weeds about why this is coming forward. So thank you for bringing this forward, and thank you to the testifiers.
Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. And I guess my question is, if you could tell me, for the states that have implemented this, that have been mentioned, are they in a fiscally sound position for their state? That's my question. And I ask that only because we have received the state budget and we know we're going into a deficit. We are going to be spending more with the policies that we've enacted than we are taking in revenue. So I just was questioning, would like just a response on the fiscal status of the states that are doing this right now. If you could answer that.
Representative Byrd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative. So the only other two states that provide striking workers with unemployment insurance are New Jersey and New York. and their legislation is actually different than what ours is calling for. Ours is actually ahead of theirs, which is why we call it nation leading. And I do not, quite frankly, know the fiscal state of New Jersey and New York, but I don't know if research has some idea of how what this looks like implemented in New York and New Jersey, which is still a little bit different than what we're proposing. Or otherwise, I could call Jake back up to the table to assist.
We'll have the testifier respond. Welcome to committee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Chair Zhang, thank you. Jake Schweitzer again with North Star Policy Action. Representative, to your question, this money comes out of the UI Trust Fund, so not the general fund. I can't speak to New York and New Jersey's overall budget balance, but the key question is the UI Trust Fund here. And in our case, our UI Trust Fund is in very solid fiscal shape here in Minnesota. And Chair, if I can address the previous question about the 0.3% question, if I may. So our math looked at recent numbers of workers going on strike, how many workers tend to claim unemployment insurance, and that's how we arrived at our math. And the total estimated unemployment insurance benefits for all striking workers would be around $203,000, give or take. So that's the number we're talking about here.
Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you. No further questions.
Any further discussion on the bill? Okay. Seeing none, Representative Byrd, closing comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the time today. Thank you to all of my labor friends in the crowd. Really appreciate you seeing here. So as I mentioned, I've been here 4 years, but I've been a union member for 20 years. And while we hope that there is never a need to strike, if there is a strike line, I'm on it. I have been with the nurses. I've been with Marathon. I have been with my own union, the airline unions. This is about workers being able to fight for what they deserve. But oftentimes, the way this has worked historically is that they have to give something up in order to fight for what is rightfully theirs. And it's time that we end that dynamic. As we saw today in our testimony, the stories we heard, and as we looked at it fiscally and being responsible for that, for what it actually looks like out of the UI fund, not only is this legislation possible, it's critical, and we can actually lead the nation in what it looks like to support striking workers. Thank you so much for your time. I urge you to support this bill.
Okay, thank you, Representative Berg. Chair Becca Fenn will renew her motion that House File 3446, as amended, be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails and the bill is on its way. Next is House File 3709, Representative Senator Mira.
Let's go.
Representative Senator Mira. Moves that House File 3709 be laid over for possible inclusion. If I could have folks in the audience, please keep your voices down. We are still having a hearing going on, so I appreciate it. Representative Senator Mira, to your bill.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Zhang. House File 3709 is before the committee. This is to support a program through the International Institute of Minnesota. The International Institute of Minnesota is located in St. Paul and has successfully been welcoming new Americans to our community for more than 100 years. The Institute helps new Americans, refugees, and immigrants realize their talents and ambitions through outcomes-based education and employment programs, immigration services, and refugee services, supporting new arrivals to our community. And in the last year, the Institute served over 4,500 new Americans. Nearly half of them were served in education and workforce training programs and ongoing critical services that help new Americans have a strong start to their lives in Minnesota. The Institute's Medical Careers Pathways program was recognized by the Department of Labor in their top 10 workforce training programs in the United States. And they are going to use the success of that program to build the Business Career Pathway program, and that's what they are here before us today to ask for funding and support for. So I have two testifiers from the International Institute here with me today, and I'll turn it over to them.
Welcome to committee. Please identify yourself for the record, share your pronouns if you'd like, and proceed with the testimony.
Thank you, Chair Zhang and members of the committee. I'm Jane Grotman, the Executive Director of the International Institute of Minnesota. Before I begin my testimony, I want to give a special thank you to Representative Senator Mira for sponsoring our bill and also just being a supporter of new Americans in our community. We really, really appreciate her support. So the International Institute's committed to providing quality services for new Americans, as well as accountability for the outcomes we produce and the funds that we receive. The services we offer move lives forward, as well as the economic health of our state. In this bill, we are asking for support for the Institute's business career pathway, and it's the first time we've requested funds for this pathway. The pathway offers customized professional leadership training held at the Institute for 12 weeks, totaling 96 hours, to help participants move into the business sector or advance within the sector to a higher position with higher wages. This course helps new Americans build their confidence, their business skills and acumen, as well as their communication and technology skills. And those are all really critical to succeed in the business sector. It also connects graduates with business leaders through our employer partner connections and through members of our own board of directors. One of our board of directors, an employee of Accenture, a business consulting firm, is helping to fulfill the directive of their CEO, Julie Sweet, who's publicly committed to hiring refugees in particular and helping them advance within Accenture, which is very exciting. The majority of Pathway graduates in 2023 were placed in assistant manager, supervisory, and office-based positions. 37 graduates were employed in 2023, and had a one-year job retention rate of 92%, which you've heard me say also over 90% retention rates for our healthcare employee too, in program two. These requested funds will allow us to expand the pathway to serve 150 students, doubling the numbers that we've served previously and increasing the numbers employed by 30%. It will expand professional leadership classes and support a new entrepreneurship class that incorporates expanded business and technology skills training. That course will be 8 weeks with 72 hours of training. The business sector has been challenging for new Americans to enter and to advance within. We are very committed to providing quality training, but also working with employers, partners, to help them successfully hire and advance new Americans. Finally, I want to thank this committee for the Institute's direct appropriation in the last session for our medical careers pathway. With this and other funding, private funding that we have, the program is expanding to serve the community need that, you know, we all know we have in healthcare by increasing our training to provide 60 additional nursing assistants in the community and advancing additional new Americans into RN nursing positions, so urgently needed in our community, as you know. So thank you so much for the opportunity to testify. And next, I have the pleasure to introduce one of our successful business pathway graduates, Sandra Salinas.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, share your pronouns if you'd like, and proceed with your testimony.
Chair Xiong and members of the committee, my name is Sandra Salinas. I'm from Peru, and I now live and work in Minnesota. I have come a long way, both personally and professionally, since arriving here in 2018. With support from the International Institute of Minnesota, I worked my way from speaking minimal English to my dream job at Target Corporation. Before arriving, I worked as a visual merchandiser for Puma in Argentina. I had planned to look for a similar professional job here. However, the reality of living and working as an immigrant in Minnesota was more difficult than I expected. Fortunately, the Institute's business career pathway gave me the tools I needed to help me transform my career. I began by first taking English and then college readiness classes at the Institute. These classes helped me prepare for earning an online design certificate from Pratt Institute, one of the world's top 10 design colleges. During this time, I also worked an entry-level retail job at Target to pay my bills. But this was not my dream job, and it did not use my many years of experience in visual merchandising. Despite my talent, I had no professional contacts here or understanding of how to break into the American workforce. The Institute Professional Leadership Training, which is part of the Institute Business Pathway, helped me to harness my ambition and give it direction. I learned about American workplace culture and communication and how to promote myself. This helped me gain confidence, and that helped me meet leaders at Target Corporation who are still my mentors today. During my professional leadership training, I also learned how to upgrade my resume and cover letter, interviewing skills, and how to apply for corporate jobs. And I learned how to identify and develop my skills to become a successful leader. I'm thrilled to share that after 4 years arriving in Minnesota, speaking minimal English, last year I was hired as a senior stylist at Target Corporation. If you have been at any Target store or seen advertisement, you have seen the influence of my work. This job has doubled my income, and now I own my first home in Golden Valley. I cannot thank the International Institute enough for the training I received. I will not be where I am today without them. Thank you for your work and for listening to my story.
Thank you so much for sharing your story, Ms. Salinas. Discussion on the bill. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Chair Zhang, and thank you, Representative Senator Mira, and testifiers. You know, I can't imagine what it is moving to a completely new place, having some understanding of the language. I've traveled around the world a bit, you know, the language barrier is real. I mean, there's enough places that understand English that you can communicate, but I couldn't imagine moving and trying to get a job and come into that. And so I just want to say, you know, congratulations on doing that and, you know, achieving your dream. And I think, you know, it sounds like there's a lot of things that the Institute is really valuable on helping really transition and settle people in and really make them part of our economy. And as, you know, we look at workforce, you know, this is something that's really needed. And just the one thing that kind of caught my eye is, you know, the request of $251,680. You know, quite often we'd see a request for $200,000 or $250,000. And that's probably my question is, you know, it's a kind of a somewhat specific number and kind of wondering how you arrived at that. I mean, it's just, it's not a number I oppose, but it's not just a round number. So thank you.
I asked the same question too. So, Ms. Kaltman, did you want to respond to?
Yes, Chair Zhang and Representative. That's not the first time we've heard that question. We put a budget together for what we needed the funding for. So this would help us hire an additional instructor, an employment counselor, and an additional staff, and that's what it totaled. So it's the actual amount. We just didn't round up.
Representative Nelson.
No, thank you for that answer. And, you know, and I think that's, you know, I think it's admirable that you, you know, took it and you didn't round up or round down. You know, you looked at what your need was and asked for that. So I appreciate that. And, you know, thank you for your work that you do.
Further discussion to the bill. Representative Weems.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Sensenmura, Ms. Salinas, Ms. Grautman. Rep. Nelson sort of asked a couple of my questions, but I do have to say that the Institute's a remarkable organization. What you've done for over a century, helping people integrate, understand our system, and Ms. Salinas is a great example of that. I am always curious when we donate taxpayers' money for a specific project such as this, and I like what you're doing with entrepreneurship and leadership, but I look at your charitable giving ratio, and that's another one that's a top line. You guys do a great job. So maybe this is for Ms. Grautman. If you could tell us what's your secret to success for such a high charitable giving ratio back to the community.
Ms. Grautman.
Thank you, Chair Zhang and Representative Weens. You know, I think the secret to most success is just hard work, but also we have, we work with amazing people. You're seeing one of them here. We have lots of people like Sandra at the Institute that are just incredibly, they've had many, many decades of their lives taken from them. People living, when I started this work 34 years ago, refugees were living in camps for 2 to 3 years. At that time, coming from mostly Southeast Asia, which is plenty of time to live in a refugee camp. And now people are living there for 2 decades or more. People are being born in refugee camps, and the number of people in camps has really increased. So people, when people come to the Institute, we take it very seriously. They've had a big part of their life robbed from them for no fault of their own. And so when they come through our doors, we have to do what's going to help them move their lives forward. And the great thing is they tell us where are they meeting barriers out in the community, what do they need help with, what is holding them back. And so our staff are really excellent at listening, and then over time trying to get funding for that. You know, funding for nonprofits is always a challenge. Really important that we're diversifying our funding. So for this program, we have private funding as well as government funding. So that's always, we're always working at that and always trying to increase the sources of revenue that we receive. And that's very hard work. But we so appreciate that your comments, your acknowledgement. We really appreciate that. We welcome any of you to come visit and see our work firsthand. It's an amazing place to work. I feel super lucky to have been there for 34 years. And we welcome you to come to visit firsthand and see what we do. Thank you.
Representative Weems.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that answer. Keep up the great work. This is good work we need in our community. Thank you.
Thank you.
Further discussion to the bill? Seeing none. Representative Sensenbrera, closing comments?
Yeah, thank you so much for the conversation today. I'm glad to hear about the bipartisan support for this bill and this work. You know, when we think about this program and funding programs like it, I think it's just really important to emphasize that, you know, we get so much back as a state from these programs. We know that Minnesota has a rich history of welcoming immigrants and refugees. And I know that I've had so many heartbreaking conversations with community members who talk about all of the gifts and talents and what they were able to build in their home country and then come to our state and just face a lot of barriers to be able to share that with the broader community. And so I think it's really important that we invest in programs like International Institute to make sure that everyone can come here and share their gifts. I know that I have certainly benefited from gifts like Miss Selena's. I know that when I go into Target, I go in for one thing and end up spending a lot more based on the styling there. And so I would just love to see more entrepreneurs and business people like her be able to be thriving in our community. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Sensenbrera. Representative Sensenbrera renews her motion on House File 3709. Be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next on the agenda is House File 3475, Representative Mueller. I will move that House File 3475 be laid over for possible inclusion. Welcome to the committee, Representative Mueller. I had the opportunity to speak with you a couple of days ago about your bill, so I'm excited to hear about what you have here today and hear from your testifiers. So, to your bill, Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Chair Zhang, and thank you, committee members, for the opportunity to have my bill heard today. I have a couple amazing people with me to talk about the bill, and first time to be in workforce, so that's great.
Where's the treats?
This isn't my first bill as a freshman, though, so we're fine.
we're
good. I'm sure Mayor King would be happy to give you some spam later if you need it.
All right.
Thank you so much. House File 3475 is actually one of the number one priorities in southern Minnesota for as the need that we have for water operators and wastewater operators has continued to be lacking in southeastern Minnesota. And so we have this bill would be a one-time appropriation to request fund development for both water and wastewater operator program to develop a pathway for licensure that would be held in Riverland Community College. Riverland Community College is both in Owatonna, Albert Lea, and Austin. And so this is a one-time appropriation to not only have development of curriculum and materials, but also have a chance to kind of have a PR to, hey, come on over to go through this program. The goals of this bill is to encourage more people in southern Minnesota to join these career paths and to have a training program that is closer to home so that we can actually meet the needs of what we're seeing. We want to protect waterways for wildlife and recreation, protect groundwater for health and sustainability, and we want to offer training that is comprehensive, hands-on, and follow training criteria outlined by MPCA, MDH. And so this is going to be able to reduce travel costs as the only training program right now is up in northern Minnesota. And so since we're seeing such a drastic need and a critical need in southern Minnesota, we're hoping that we'd be able to have a more direct pathway for our citizens to be able to do this. And I'm going to, if it's okay with you, Chair Zhang, I'd like to turn it over to my testifiers. I have Mayor King from Austin, and then I have Brenda Johnson, who has been working with southeastern municipalities for the last 3 years on this project.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and your pronouns if you'd like, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Zhang. I'm hoping you hear me between two microphones. and members, I first want to recognize the treats. You ask anybody in Austin, Minnesota, who brings treats to a meeting, it's going to be me.
That's 100% true.
And actually, who steals the treats to bring them to the meeting, it's going to be me.
Also him.
I will steal them off people's desks. But thanks for allowing us to hear, to testify in this bill. I'm here on behalf of the roughly 60 cities in southeast Minnesota, League of Municipalities, referencing about 240 operators of wastewater and water facilities. The MPCA has changed some rules over the years. A lot of these wastewater treatment plants, Austin included, is rebuilding our 100-year-old plant. Served it certainly a nice, useful life. But with these rules, with these operators, and the way it's operated, we're going from a completely biological system to treated with chemicals. And that requires a lot of licensures, updates, and employees that have licensure. So what this bill would do is give $350,000 to Riverland Community College to start up a program to address those 240 operators, potential operators, that will need to be in our cities operating such in high capacity treatment facilities. So this is definitely a need. When Southeast Minnesota comes to the legislature, it's always about need. This isn't a want. I can't imagine a bigger impact on communities and the state as much as clean water and wastewater is. So this would be very helpful. Riverland has a great reputation. The location is important. I think there's two other educational facilities that operate this way in getting the education to these potential treatment, wastewater and treatment operators. And so we would just like to lessen the impact on families of travel and expenses and have one of three be in southeast Minnesota to address the need, ongoing need, to have licensed wastewater operators. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Next testifier, please state your name for the record, say the pronouns you like, and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Brenda. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Brenda Johnson. I'm the director for the Southeastern Minnesota League of Municipalities. And Mayor King is correct that we have currently recorded just in the last day that there are 240 water and wastewater operators that are going to be heading into training just in the next 3 years. Now, keep in mind that that data was gathered in one day. That does not cover all the cities in southeast, south central, and southwestern Minnesota. So what the total number will be, it's going to be more than that. We just don't know how much. But that makes for a stronger program. Where will the instructors come from? We have a great number of people retiring from these fields. That is part of what's driving the need to have closer training, more convenient training. That is the thing that we're hearing from cities is it costs so much money, especially for the small cities. It's a huge deal for them. They're training people over and over again as people get hired out to other cities. So in a sense, yes, it's good for southern Minnesota. It's also good for the rest of the state because we won't be stealing your operators from your cities, and you'll be having some operators getting trained in our part of the state that will fill out that entire field, that entire range of operators available in our state. That's what we really need. So, yeah, we've got lots of people that want it. I've been working with cities from La Center to Laverne. We are southeast Minnesota, but this serves all of southern Minnesota.
Thank you. This is our discussion on the bill. Lead Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for bringing this bill forward, Representative. What is interesting to me about this is that, I'm associated with Ridgewater College System. You guys have a fabulous system with Riverland. And standing up programs like this is exactly what we should be doing. In this case, and again, I hope that students and seats there protect and really sustain this program for many years. Will we be able to recruit folks on the same level of training from other neighboring states, Wisconsin, Iowa? I don't know how different our rules are for water, clarity and things, safety. But is that something that would be a possibility for the future?
To the testifier.
Mr. Chair, and thank you for that question. My understanding is that they would still have to have the state, Minnesota state, licensing. And there would be a transition period where perhaps they could come in and be under a current state-licensed operator for water or wastewater, whichever is appropriate, but they would still have to get the state licensing done. And they would need to do that with some refresher programs to see what is different, what kinds of things they need to maybe brush up on, things like that, before they would take the test. And these programs are not just for people who are already in the field. We're going to be recruiting from wherever possible. In other words, the groups that are working on this, it's not just the cities. We are partnering not only with Riverland, but also the workforce centers across all of southern Minnesota. They're highly interested. They know there's a need. And they get people who come in who have the aptitude but aren't even aware that these types of things are available. So with having all these partners, not only the Department of Health, MPCA, Riverland, the workforce centers, the Southeast League is going to be doing its part. We meet four times a year. We work with cities. We have actually 84 member cities in the Southeast League, and we're reaching out to all the cities across southern Minnesota on this particular topic so that we can basically help to funnel information to Riverland and to the workforce centers on here's the needs of cities, here's where their jobs are. I think cities need to have more ways to get the word out. That's part of that whole recruitment thing. You're seeing some numbers here that may not look like it's all program development, and that's because it's true. Recruitment is a huge part of this whole project.
Lead Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I couldn't agree more. I think it's great. I hope it stands up really well. You know, it's not very often we get to hear this kind of a bill that really reflects with our community colleges. This is a higher ed question. I'm really supportive of this idea, and also want to thank, you know, again, Representative Mueller for breaking this down for us, the 350, and how it's going to be kind of spent, and where is it kind of going. That we need to see more of all that. So thank you for that. And I don't know where the next stop is, but is this planning to go to higher education? Because I think this is certainly a pathway that they need to hear what our state, you know, colleges should be involved with. What's the plan?
I would
have Mr. Chair. Lee Baker, the motion earlier made was to lay over for possible inclusion.
Mr. Chair, could I make a motion to move it to higher ed just because I think they should hear it too? Is that something that we could do or not?
Mr. Chair, I don't know what the pathway was. It passed unanimously out of jobs in the Senate, and I don't know where it went from there. Maybe we could look and see where the Senate is putting it and maybe mirror the path of that. I would have no problem with it going to higher ed, to just even say, hey, look, this is an amazing thing that we're doing, and this is what we should be doing. As a teacher for almost 20 years, I talk so much about how we should have multiple pathways for job training, multiple pathways to success in these areas. And so I understand, I defer to you, Mr. Chair, but if we want to look and see where the Senate is taking it, we can maybe mirror that.
I'll have staff look up and see where the Senate.
It's been laid over. It's been laid over.
It was laid over in the committee, so it's up to you if you want to go to.
Well, to Mr. Chair, again, I don't want to make more work. We have a short session. I understand that. I just, what I hear once in a while, though, through these discussions are even really good bills should be heard when you can in other communities, in other committees, because I hate to see them kind of surprised by something coming to the House floor or something. So I just offer it as advice, really, to the majority. You guys can make that decision. But I do hope at some point that the higher ed committee, or at least the chairs, know what's happening, and they can also be supportive. This is a good bill. And this, I think, is a kind of a bill that we might and should see more of to help build and stand up programs in our local community colleges that really are the right place to get these things stood up. So this is, I think, more of a pilot or a thing that we should be doing more of through higher ed and workforce. We should be working closer together, just like you're proposing to do. So thank you for that.
Representative Nelson.
Well, thank you, Chair Jong and Representative Mueller. You know, thank you for bringing this bill forward. And I, you know, echo Lead Baker's comments. And I probably wasn't paying full enough attention to the testimony, but is this looking to be like a two-year degree, or is this like a more of a short-term, like a certification to come in and get the appropriate training? So I know our community colleges can do both, and oftentimes I know Pine Tech, you know, they do a lot of short-term courses that do much of this, and so I don't know if I wasn't paying attention or if that wasn't answered, so...
Probably both.
Representative Mueller.
Good chance.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, this far.
This is not your typical program. It's a customized training program. And the training is designed to meet the needs for people who want to get the state licensing. So that's really where their certificate comes from, is from either the Department of Health for their water operating license or the MPCA for their wastewater operator license. A certificate or whatever from the local community college, wherever it would be, does not provide a license, and they've got to have that to run these facilities.
Representative Nelson.
So, yeah, thank you for that. That does help clarify this. And I think, again, I think this is, you know, really providing that training that is needed to be able to, you know, somebody be able to take a test and to be able to get the certification through, you know, the appropriate department. You know, and I think that's many ways of what our community colleges are doing. And you're really being able to fit that need, be able to provide the training and education that is needed. And it's often overlooked, but, you know, thank you for bringing this forward. And, you know, we're happy to work on that. And is there any way you could get more of a specific number than 350,000? I mean, no, I'm just kidding.
Any further comments on the bill? Seeing none, closing statement.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. We really, you know, as a teacher for almost 20 years, the way that we are seeing education going with, especially after COVID, is people are looking for something that meets their need right away. And I believe that our community colleges are that linchpin. They are the linchpin to start looking at, you know, individual pathways and looking at what are the needs in the community and filling those needs. And so I, you know, the request of the chair was to see how much the need was going to be, and we tasked Brenda to do that in one day, and she continues to get emails over and over. She got 240 people that say, wow, we see this need. And that serves over, you know, half a million people that need clean water, that need to have functioning infrastructure. So the need is there. The cost is not going to be such a burden that we are seeing the impact be so great. And so I really appreciate the support, and would just also like to say that we did see unanimous support from the Senate, and so or the other body, I apologize, oh my goodness, but so I appreciate the support of the committee. Thank you, Chair Tom.
Thank you, Representative Mueller, and to the mayor and testifiers. I sit on the Capital Investment Committee, so last fall we had the opportunity to tour your great city and also Riverland College, and so appreciate you all making up here to share about the opportunities that we can make impact in all over our state. So that being said, I will renew my motion that House File 3475 be labeled with possible inclusion. Seeing no further items on the agenda, we are adjourned.